This program is brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you like what you hear and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.
I am a piano player. I doubt it, honestly, because I'm saying, hey, I'm 60 years, you got some free time. but primarily, I play piano. I write, and then I play what I wrote, or whatever. Or I play, and then I write what I played, you know, whichever fucking way. But it all works into that. And I'm comfortable doing that. I like to share that with people. I have always felt as though, like, you need to have a place to go where you can lock out your job. You know, if I want to work there, you know, there's a piano there and there's a word processor and all that, but that's not mandatory. You know, you need to have a place you can go, and at the door to my room, you know, leave all the other shit outside, you know, all the other things that's bothering you, all the other people who's on your nerves and shit, leave that out there. Come on in, let's do something else. You know, we play cards or backgammon or what the fuck ever. You know, but I don't want to hear it. You know, you don't want to talk about it, not really. So let's not do that.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com on the net. And today's guest is Sandra Cross, sometimes known as DJ Hybridist.
Hello, William.
Good afternoon. Again, you've been a frequent visitor.
Yes.
What was the last show we were talking about?
I think it was for International Women's Day.
Yeah,
it was nice to do that.
Yeah, yeah. So we played, what, June Tabor and various other things.
No. I think that might have been, that's an earlier memory, an older memory of a previous program.
Okay.
No, we did lots of spoken word, Jean Rhys, Virginia Woolf.
Celebration
of Women's Day.
So today's show is an appreciation of Gil Scott-Heron.
Yeah.
Hence those two tracks that we've just listened to.
Yeah. Those. I thought it'd be nice to start with him in his own words, in his own voice, talking, because his voice is so very special, I think. And unfortunately, those two little pieces that we heard come from his last ever recording on the bonus track of I'm New Here, which was his, as I say, the last thing he ever did.
Right. When does that date from?
I think it was recorded in 2010 and he died in 2011.
Right. We actually went to a concert of his, which must have been very towards the end of his life.
I think it must have been, yeah, if only looked at from the point of view of he was not really in very good shape, and he apparently hadn't been in good shape for quite some time, and had slipped away out of public view. Had spent time in jail apparently for drugs offences, not for dealing, just for possession of Class A drugs, I guess. And was resurrected. His career was somewhat resurrected by a British record producer called Richard Russell, who I haven't heard of, but we could probably get onto that later.
But when we saw him at the Festival Hall.
He was not in very good shape, and I think I said to you at the time, I felt that he should have had greater guidance, really, because he was still doing that thing that he always appears to do, which is to give an awful lot, and he was still trying to give a lot, but I don't think he had a lot left.
Right. Okay.
And he wasn't able to use his voice very well, and he looked very... he was at a very small keyboard, wasn't he?
Well, my abiding memory was that he came on and talked for what seemed an inordinate length of time.
Yes.
He delivered this, what, like he was talking to the audience, but it seemed to go on for what incredible, like almost like 20 minutes until people were getting a bit impatient with it.
Well, there was a certain restlessness which was also assisted by somebody in the audience, I seem to remember, who took exception to one of his tour dates, which apparently, I don't know whether it's true or false, was going to include Israel,
right,
which these people were opposed to. Yeah. Anyway, this is to go completely off the track and is not at all celebratory.
All right, you get me back on track. I don't want to divert
you. So we're on track now, and now, having started with the last recordings he made, we're going to hear something that's sort of, I suppose, before his slide. This comes from a recording that was made in round about 2000, when apparently he was playing at the Jazz Cafe. I didn't see him, but hearing this program whetted my appetite for him, although I had heard of him before. And so now we're going to hear him, in his own words again, reading one of his poems. It's about Dr. Martin Luther King.
Okay.
This is one of my favorites because it comes from a book that we've done called The Last Holiday, and it covers the tour that Stevie Wonder undertook in order to get Dr. King's birthday legislated to national attention, and this was about Dr. King himself. It says, "I had honestly never given much thought as to how much of a battle might have to be fought to get most Americans to agree and to say that there actually should be a black holiday. But what a hell of a challenge. How far was Steve willing to go to make them pass an amendment left on the table 10 years in a row? I had never doubted that Stevie was sincere, but how many minds had changed in the last 12 years? How many folks recognized how much America had to grow? And who else had been qualified to lead us where we had to go? I'd always liked the idea of a minister being around when racing for high stakes to have his foot near the brakes because of what truly could have gone down. Because America could have blown up before it ever could have said that it had grown up. Gandhi took nonviolence with him when he died. In America, there was nonviolence, but only on one side. When white folks beat up or killed some people that you knew, you decided to direct your anger at a building or two, instead of making the Old Testament a civil rights guide and saying that an eye for an eye would now be justified. We were told to accept that some white folks had no class, and as opposed to condemning all of them en masse, we determined that remaining peaceful was the best thing, and directing those feelings were men like Dr. King. Through a storm of provocation to fight, we saw that in order to change America, you must change the law. We were called militant and radical and made to look bad for trying to secure the rights that all Americans had. But between what's written and what's done is the real thing, so America might not have made it without Dr. Martin Luther King." That's the point about it.
So, right, so that obviously that was Gil Scott-Heron reading his poem, and that's a reading from 2000, as I say. And that was a poem that appeared in the book The Last Holiday, which is described as a memoir, which is also described as being about Gil Scott-Heron going on this really extensive nationwide tour with Stevie Wonder, who, as you heard there, was trying to get Martin Luther King's birthday to be a national sort of celebration. But the book, I kept thinking to myself, why doesn't this sound like Gil Scott-Heron? And then I got to the end of the book and realised that, in fact, it had been put together after his death from a series of little scraps that he'd been writing, you know, notebooks and various bits and bobs, which is why it doesn't really sound like him. So it's worthwhile reading, but doesn't quite have his voice throughout.
Right, OK. So was he known as he's a poet first of all, or poet before he was a singer? Or?
When we come to it, further on, we'll get him back in his own voice describing how he views himself. So we'll leave that for later.
Okay.
But yes, he's a writer first. That's how he thinks of himself. He thinks of himself.
Obviously,
as a writer.
I keep diverting you in the wrong direction. You'll have to just sort of slap me back.
Keep me on the
straight and narrow.
Okay.
Because can I divert again?
Yeah.
Briefly before we move on.
So long as it's not too.
Well, because I think it's something to do with this memoir. What's the story about his father playing for Celtic or something?
Yes, well, that's two lines, really.
Okay.
His father didn't live with his mother for very long, and he was a Jamaican a GI who served in the Canadian Air Force.
Right.
And he was the first black player to play for Celtic FC.
Wow.
And that's as much as I know.
All
and
right.
I think that's as much as anybody knows.
But isn't that doesn't that feature in a particular book? Is there some other book which is only about the father? Or
there is, yes, but I haven't read that book. I'm not very interested in his father.
Oh, okay.
I'm much more interested in him.
All right, okay. All
and
right.
I mean, he doesn't talk about his father. In fact, he only talks about the women in his life.
Okay.
And that's... I mean, I haven't read extensively about him. This, The Last Holiday, is described as a memoir.
Right.
But there, you know, there is reference.
You sound a bit suspicious of the book. You think it's been put cobbled together in some way? Or?
Well, like I said, it wasn't put together by Gil Scott-Heron.
Right.
Although it's called Gil Scott-Heron, a memoir.
Right. So it's a posthumous memoir, which is
a memoir put together from his notes and diaries and bits and bobs.
Okay.
But it's put together by somebody who isn't got Gil Scott-Heron, and there was he does have a very unique way.
Yeah.
About
I'm going to be steered by you. So,
okay.
So do you want to mention the books or where do we go from here?
Well, I think because we need to line up for, we're going to have another reading, Gil Scott reading from A Broken Home, but I don't know, are we there yet?
Yeah, we're ready. I can play this tape. We have various forms of media here. We've got CD, LPs, and even a cassette recorder.
We may not need to hear the whole of that. It's just what I'm trying to do is, because it's quite long, it's 7 minutes long, might just hear some of that, because then it is followed with Gil actually singing that song. All of his poems weren't always recorded. Some remained poems on the written page. But this is one that
was he. Do you think he was primarily a poet, or was he, did he not differentiate between the activities of music and poetry? Or
he thought of himself, as I say, there is a bit later in which
Should we just play
himself.
This tape?
Yeah.
You as a person and your history.
We never do that.
Well, okay. In that case, read at least some of. I come from Broken Home, or what? Sorry, what's it
called? This is called Coming from a Broken Home. It's from the Now and Then collection. It says, I want to make this a special tribute, since I am a primary tributary and a contributory, as it were, to a family that contradicts the concepts, heard the rules but wouldn't accept, and women folk raised me, and I was full grown before I knew I came from a broken home. Oh yeah, since I lived with my grandma down south, wonder why they call it down if the world is really round. When my uncle was leaving and my grandfather had just left for heaven, they said, and as every ologist would certainly note, I had no strong male figure, right? But Lily Scott was absolutely not your mail order room service typecast black grandmother. On tiptoe, she might have been 5'2", and in an overcoat, maybe 110, but light and light skinned because she was half white, from Alabama and Georgia and Florida and Africa. Lily Scott claimed to have gone as far as the third grade in school herself, but she put four Scots, but she put four Scots through college with her husband going blind. God rest his soul, a good man, Bob Scott. And I'm talking about work. Lily worked through them teens and them 20s and them 30s and them 40s when work was really work, and put all four of hers through college, and pulled and pushed and coaxed folks all around her through and over other things. I was moved in with her, temporarily, just until things were patched, till this was patched, until that was patched, until I became at 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10, the patch that held Lily Scott, who held me, and like them four, I became one more, and I loved her from the absolute marrow of my bones, and we was holding on. I come from a broken home. She could take hers and outdo yours, she could take yours and outdo hers. She might not have been in the class by herself, but it sure didn't take long to call the roll. She had more than the five senses, no more than books could teach, and raised everyone she touched just a little bit higher. Common sense became uncommon, and you could sense that she had it. And all around her, there was a natural sense, as though she sensed what the stars would say, what the birds would say, what the wind and the clouds would say, a sense of soul and self, that African sense. And work like you're building something of your own, she'd say, full time, overtime, all the time, no nonsense. And she raised me like she raised four of her own, who were like her in a good many ways,
which showed up in my mother, who was truly her mother's daughter and still her own person. And I was hurt and scared and shocked when Lily Scott left suddenly one night and they sent a limousine from heaven to take her to God, if there is one. So I knew that she had gone. So I come from a broken home. The part we were interested in, though, was talking about how it is with folks. So I'm remembering now she showed me more caring and sharing than I deserved, more courage and daring than I had.
I want to make this a special tribute to a family that contradicts the concepts, heard the rules but wouldn't accept, and women folk raised me and I was full grown before I knew I came from a broken home. Since I lived with my grandma down south, where my uncle was leaving and my grandfather had just left for heaven, they said. And as every ologist would certainly note, I had no strong male figure, right? But Lily Scott was absolutely not your mail order, room service, typecast black grandmother. I was moved in with her, temporarily, just until things were patched. Till this was patched, until that was patched. Until I became at 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10, the patch that held Lily Scott, who held me. And like them four, I became one more. And I loved her from the absolute marrow of my bones. And we was holding on. I come from a broken home. She had more than the five senses. She knew more than books could teach. And raised everyone she touched just a little bit higher. And all around her, there was a natural sense. As though she sensed what the stars say, what the birds say, what the wind and the clouds say. A sense of soul and self, that African sense. And she raised me like she raised four of her own. And I was hurt and scared and shocked when Lily Scott left suddenly one night. And they sent a limousine from heaven to take her to God, if there is one. So I knew she had gone. And I came from a broken home.
So that's two versions of the same text, basically.
That's right, yes.
One just read as a poem, the other one with this sort of...
What did you think?
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, the second one, the soundtrack behind it sounds incredibly sort of strangely muted, obviously a deliberate... It's almost like a recording being played from another era or something compared
well,
with his voice.
Well, that's some of these samples, interestingly, from... I don't know if that's one, a Kanye West... sample, but a lot of the that's on the last I'm New Here,
okay,
with this Richard Russell producer,
right?
So they have sampled more contemporary artists,
right?
So
with him talking over it,
with him talking over,
all right.
So I mean, I like both of them. I don't know which I prefer because actually in this one I suppose what I'm trying to get away from slightly is the very percussive Gil Scott-Heron, you know, where you've got this sort of, you know, funky, you know, the background and it sort of swamps out the voice, really. And his voice is just fantastic, really.
Right.
It's just so emotional and so full of...
Was his voice always like that when he started?
No. Well, we will hear his voice later when it doesn't sound... I mean, now it's when you heard him just then.
Mm.
This is at the end of his life. This is 2010, just before he dies in 2011.
Yeah.
And so I suppose you can feel the weight of that life, really.
Yeah. All right.
So now we have the answer to your question with the Gil talking about his working process.
Oh, okay. So we're back to the cassette deck.
Yeah.
So this is his working process. When does this... Is this from the same recording then? This is
from
the same era.
Yeah, this is from 2000 when he was appearing at the Jazz Cafe.
Maria, or was your kind of
few people doing music of that sort of nature. I wanted to be a novelist.
Yeah, of course.
And that's what I set out to be, and that's what I released first, which was The Vulture, and after that, The Nigger Factory, and have continued to write. So I wanted to be a writer, and the spirits have been kind to me. They blessed me and allowed me to do what I want to do. But I also enjoy performing as well as songwriting. So there's nothing that I get more pleasure out of, or more actual contact and response from than performing. And so I've been blessed, you know, and allowed to do the sort of things that allow you to, like, work on long-term projects on the one hand, which is what a novel is, and on the other hand, get the immediate stimulation and encouragement to keep on working, which is like what performing is, because you get a chance to play and do something you enjoy while the other people there who enjoy it also. Like, there's nothing better that I can think of.
So you got those two things.
Yeah. So that was, I do recognize a voice there that keeps coming in.
Yeah.
So is that the end of that recording, or does it continue?
It continues, yeah.
That's what happens every night when we're performing.
You mentioned earlier on, in the course of...
Sorry. sorry.
That's all right.
You were right the first time.
Yeah.
So, yes, that was that. So there's a little bit of him describing how he views himself. Unfortunately, I think we missed the beginning of that, in which he talks about... He does also think of himself as a piano player. That's what he does. He plays piano. Okay. But he seems to be avoiding this... part in which he's the sort of singer, I suppose. He's not really,
right.
He doesn't describe that, does he? At the beginning of that tape, which we missed the beginning of it.
Sure.
He says, I'm a piano player. Then he says he thinks of himself as having been a novelist or wanting to be a novelist.
Okay. So was he? Did he have a band as such, or was he just always just?
He had a series of different bands.
Right.
We're here, in a minute we're going to hear his first recording, which is Small Talk at 125th and Lennox.
I get the impression that you've picked stuff right from the very, very beginning and stuff right from the very end.
That's right, yeah.
Because the middle stuff is more musical, that's not to your taste.
Well, no, it's not that it isn't to my taste, it's very much to my taste, but I think it's very familiar to listeners. And I think this is... And also what I'm trying to do is highlight his voice, which is free of the other stuff.
Yeah.
I love all of it, but a lot of it is very well known. I think hopefully I'm choosing things which aren't quite so well known.
I suppose he's most well known, I think, for The Revolution Will Not Be Televised.
And that's exactly what we're going to hear now, but...
It is a statement that has come to be strangely dated in a way, because now people say that actually, if there is a revolution, it will be televised.
Yes,
Or not televised, it will actually be filmed and seen. So it seemed very, very relevant for a long time, as though this would be suppressed. But now it's almost as though there is too much a visual.
Although in certain cultures, the footage that we saw the other day on primetime TV in Budapest, the authorities do not allow you, or they don't allow TV stations to film it.
Right.
It was up to people with their phones to film it.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay. But he was, you know, to be very literal about this, he's talking about telly.
All right.
The telly thing.
So, shall we play this record?
Yes.
This is from one, Lennox. This is called A New Black Poet, Gil Scott-Heron, Small Talk at 125th and Lennox.
This is just like listening to a conversation being held by the many people who congregate on one of the most popular blocks in the largest area of Black America. Did you ever eat cornbread and black-eyed peas or watermelon and mustard greens? Get high as you can on Saturday night. Go to church on Sunday to set things right. Listen. I seen Miss Blake after Willie yesterday. She'd have killed anybody who'd have gotten her way. Hey, look, I got a TV for a pound on the head. And Jimmy Jean got the best Panamanian red. Nah, I ain't got on no underclothes. But the hawk got to get through this gypsy rose. I think Clay got his very good points. You say a tray bag with 13 joints? Who cares if LBJ is in town? Up with Stokely and H. Rap Brown. Well, I don't know if the riots is wrong, but Whitey been kicking my ass for too long. I suppose to, baby, but they held my pay. Did you hear what the number was yesterday? Junkies is all right when they ain't broke. They leaves you alone when they high on dope. Damn, but I wish I could get up and move. Shut up, hell, you know that ain't true.
So when does this date from?
These are all from the first album that he made, and I think the recording was 1971.
Good evening and welcome. My name is Gil Scott-Heron. My accomplices are, first from left to right, Eddie Knowles, a drummer for the Denny Zulu Dance Group, a drummer for the Simba Dancers, and a percussionist for a group called Black and Blues. The brother to my immediate left is Charlie Saunders of the Simba Dance Group and a former drummer for Loretta Parker. David Barnes, a singer for Black and Blues, will be heard later on in the evening. We'd like to do a poem for you called The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, primarily because it won't be. You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Mendel Rivers to eat hog maws confiscated from a Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia. The revolution will not give your mouth sex appeal. The revolution will not get rid of the nubs. The revolution will not make you look 5 pounds thinner. The revolution will not be televised, brother. There will be no pictures of you and Willie Mae pushing that shopping cart down the block on the dead run or trying to slide that color TV into a stolen ambulance. NBC will not be able to predict the winner at 8:32 on reports from 29 districts. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of Whitney Young being run out of Harlem on a rail with a brand new process. There will be no slow motion or still lifes of Roy Wilkins strolling through Watts in a red, black, and green liberation jumpsuit that he had been saving for just the right occasion. Green Acres, Beverly Hillbillies, and Hooterville Junction will no longer be so goddamn relevant, and women will not care if Dick finally screwed Jane on Search for Tomorrow, because black people will be in the street looking for a brighter day. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no highlights on the 11 o'clock news and no pictures of Harry Arm Women Liberationists and Jackie Onassis blowing her nose. The theme song will not be written by Jim Webb or Francis Scott Keyes, nor sung by Glenn Campbell, Tom Jones, Johnny Cash, or Engelbert Humperdinck. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be right back after a message about a white tornado, white lightning, or white people. You will not have to worry about a dove in your bedroom, the tiger in your tank, or the giant in your toilet bowl. The revolution will not go better with coke. The revolution will not fight germs that may cause bad breath. The revolution will put you in the driver's seat. The revolution will not be televised, will not be televised, not be televised. The revolution will be no rerun, brothers. The revolution will be live. We'd like to do a poem that was inspired by a still life in the subway that was a commercial for a movie called The Green Slime. And we call this poem Omen. A giant eye zapped across the screen with tentacle type, feeler type, thin roots reaching for someone, maybe me, with large black block letters chiseled into the whites around the pupils screaming R-E-V-O-L-U-T-I-O-N revolution. And as the eye, giant and green, sort of oozed with no obvious locomotion, closer and closer until it was like this on my screen. It split and blood flowed down each side of the street, washing away things that we didn't need to see. Just like beer cans, peanut shells, and copies of the Daily News. And then, laying there, bleeding like a stuck pig, was a stuck pig. Get the point?
So that was two tracks from Small Talk at 125th and Lennox. That was his first album to be released?
Yeah, I believe it was, yeah.
Okay. I've been instructed to play a very brief track now. There's a sort of brief track called Parents. Should we sneak that in now?
Yeah.
The spirits are your parents and their parents and their parents and their parents, and they are in your bloodstream and they run through your body constantly because they want you to live on because they want to live on. And they're trying all the time to tell you shit, and if you just spend a few minutes with yourself, you would hear them. You would hear them. You would hear them. You would hear them.
What's happening there? Are these like interludes between tracks on the... It's been sort of edited in some way to
Yes, to it sounds like... I don't know really what happened in the studio. I mean, maybe they were just, you know, hanging around and having these conversations and decided to record.
But on the LP, I mean, what's the we've got 1971 to
2011. Yeah.
So that's 40 years. There's a 40-year difference here.
Yeah.
But on the LP, it sounds like they're playing in a club. There's sort of a pause in between tracks and a sort of this very casual atmosphere of somebody playing the bongos and he's just talking over the top of it. But this is in fact a bit of a fallacy, isn't it? It's not a club at all, is it?
Well, you know, apparently, according to him, it wasn't a club at all. It was a recording studio. And hence the small amount of participation that you get.
Right.
I mean, it sounds, on one hand, it sounds a bit like a club, and it sounds like a club, but no, it was just a recording studio, apparently.
So that's quite interesting. There must be a story there about how that recording came about. It's quite unusual to have a recording done in a studio where people are applauding in between tracks, almost like he's brought a little clique of people with him, or it's just the other musicians or whatever.
Yes, indeed. But, you know, I suppose Sex Pistols were like, you know, there are endless examples of that kind of thing, I suppose.
Right.
Okay. You know, I mean, I think that he was on a roll in 1971. You know,
he
just had two books published. He was very young. He was at Lincoln University. He'd got people very interested in his writing, The Vulture, and the other one, The N-word, which...
Okay. Which he can say, but we can't. He mentioned it just back then.
He actually used it in order to make white people, Anglo-Saxon people, embarrassed.
Right.
That they would have to use it, or they would have to avoid using it.
Right.
Anyway, so at this time, and he also, somehow he finds his way to Flying Dutchman, who are the producers of this first album.
That's the label of the first album.
Yeah, Bob Thiel, I think, is the person who was the record producer for that label.
Right.
But he knew how to get stuff done. He was very, very proactive. He took time off from Lincoln University. He negotiated time off from his course so that he could finish The Vulture, which I started to read. It's a very good book.
Right. What sort of book is it?
It's a detective story, and it really rattles along.
Right.
But I suppose I'm more interested in the political and heartfelt. I'm sort of less interested in the fiction. I mean, you could say it's all fiction, but you know what I mean? It's kind of the Vulture and the other one are very much constructs within a genre of... But, you know, he's 20 or 21 at this time. It's a lot to be doing.
So was he hoping to be a novelist at the time?
That's what he says, isn't it? He thinks of himself as a novelist.
Right, okay.
But at the same time that he's doing all of that, and he's at Lincoln, he meets this, I think it's called Brian Jackson, who was his writing partner, not words, he was the music.
Right.
They meet at Lincoln, and he's always been playing the piano, and he's always done jobs. He always does various jobs, so one of his jobs would have been to play piano for somebody else.
Right.
Or for himself. It was just, you know, he's a bit of a, you know, an all-rounder.
Mm.
And these things...
Did he achieve success in his own terms? I mean, was he were there any rewards? I mean, you know, did he make money out of this stuff? I'm not saying that's the criteria of success, but I just wonder if he made a breakthrough with the record.
He certainly has a very big reputation.
But did that come later? Was that sort of... Did he gather...
Well,
momentum?
Winter in America was written and recorded in 1974.
Oh, really?
Okay. Pieces of a Man is 1971.
Okay.
You know, the as we just heard, the revolution, you know, which has become sort of, you say, a calling
synonymous
card.
Synonymous with his name.
Synonymous with his name, and you know, was written at this time in 1971.
Right.
So, yes, he's part of the culture.
Right.
If that's a measure of success, that isn't. That would be my measure of success.
Right.
As for the money, I don't know. I don't know how you'd find yourself living on the streets in your latter days if you had money. I don't know. I mean, once again, you know, Leonard Cohen's ripped off. You know, the music,
exactly.
Or Blondie, or whoever it is, the music business is full. I'm not suggesting
But Leonard Cohen's a good example because he was a poet as well.
Yeah.
Leonard Cohen was a poet and a published poet before before the music.
Yeah.
A little bit like the Gil Scott Heron sort of model.
Yeah.
But he did, I presume, yes, you're right, he was ripped off, wasn't he?
By his manager. She took him for millions. So to the point whereby he wasn't able to function.
But there were millions to take. I mean, did Gil Scott Heron
ever? I don't know the answer to your question. All right. I know that he produced a lot of albums and he went on a lot of tours. He was on tour with Stevie Wonder for 6 months in 1980.
Okay. Right.
So, you know, that much alone would have made him... I don't know. I don't know how money is made in the record business.
Right. But did you say earlier that he ended up on the street, or he was on living
on the street?
He was on the street
for the last 18 years of his life, I think it was. He was not in good shape.
Right.
And he spent time in jail as well.
Right.
How long these periods were, or you know, how it seems as if he didn't do anything according to the discography list that I'm now reading from, he made something called Spirits in 1994, and then the next one is 2010, I'm New Here.
Right, right.
So that's the recording career anyway.
Right. So were they, the periods in jail, was it all for drug offences or...?
It was drugs, yeah.
Right, okay.
But taking drugs himself, not...
Yeah, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hmm. All right, where do we go from there?
Well, we're now back to side two of the disc.
Yeah. So this is called, is this Whitey on the Moon?
It is.
Okay.
which is, you know, him at his humorous best, I think. And I have to say that his mother apparently provided the last lines of the song, the poem.
Oh, actually on here. Oh, she provided the lines. She wasn't actually on the...
She provided the last lines of the poem.
Right.
And it was inspired by some whiteys on the moon. So I want to give credit where credit is due. That's it.
A rat done bit my sister Nell with Whitey on the Moon. Her face and arms began to swell, and Whitey's on the moon. I can't pay no doctor bills, but Whitey's on the moon. 10 years from now, I'll be paying still while Whitey's on the moon. You know, the man just upped my rent last night, 'cause Whitey's on the moon. No hot water, no toilets, no lights, but Whitey's on the moon. I wonder why he's upping me, 'cause Whitey's on the moon. Well, I was already giving him 50 a week, and now Whitey's on the moon. Taxes taking my whole damn check. The junkies make me a nervous wreck. The price of food is going up. And as if all that crap wasn't enough, a rat done bit my sister Nell with Whitey on the moon. Her face and arms began to swell, and Whitey's on the moon. Was all that money I made last year for Whitey on the moon? How come I ain't got no money here? Whitey's on the moon. You know, I just about had my fill of Whitey on the moon. I think I'll send these doctor bills, air mail special.
To Whitey on the moon. Being blessed is not just being able to float on air. I'm saying if you got to pay for things that you've done wrong, I got a big bill coming at the end of the day.
Okay, so we're leaping from 71 to 2011, backwards and backwards and forwards.
And you can hear the change in his voice, can't you?
if you say so. Yes, obviously. I suppose that he becomes, what should we call it, a bit more gravelly or something? Or?
Well, gravelly, but also when he's on, on the Small Talk album, he sounds physically able and fit. You can feel that. You can feel the voice,
the
in
energy.
His chest, the energy, the articulation, the outward expression.
Right.
So now what we're going to do is we're going to listen to two versions of The Vulture, which is a poem from the book, which is called The Vulture.
So the book is called The Vulture and the track is called The Vulture.
Yeah.
And the same track figures in 71 and again he's done another version of it in 2011.
And so the one on Small Talk, which is the first one.
Yeah.
Yes, that's that one.
That's
and
that
then,
one. Called The
and
Vulture.
Then in the...
When was the book published? Oh, the book was published before the LP, in fact. So... the title comes from why does he call it The Vulture, do we know?
I'm not quite sure.
Apart from the obvious.
Yes, because he does have a bit of a thing about birds. It's just just about birds, some freedom, I don't know.
All right. And then The Vulture, when The Vulture reappears in 2011, it's rechristened Your Soul and Mine.
Yes, because that is a line, that is one of the lines in The Vulture.
Right.
So
it's a bit dark, isn't it?
It is dark.
Because the idea of the vulture sort of feeding on dead animals.
It's
whatever you call it, carrion or something.
Yes. So shall we hear a bit of the first
as
one?
As you like. Do you want? The one from the LP, first of all.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's rather long, so we can probably just hear a bit of that.
That's up to you. Yeah, we can talk over it or whatever.
This is called The Vulture. And a lot of people think it's a poem, and after they hear me sing it, they're sure it's a poem. But we're gonna take a shot at it anyway. Remember, this is a feel-like thing. Do whatever you feel like. If you feel like clapping your hands, you can do that. Standing in the ruins, ooh, of another black man's life. Or flying through the valley that's separating day and night. I am death, cried the vulture. Yes, for the people of the light. Charon brought his raft and came from a sea that sails on souls. Saw the scavenger departing, ooh, taking warm hearts to the cold. He knew the ghetto was a haven for the meanest creature ever known. In a wilderness of heartbreak, yes, and a desert of despair. Evil's clarion of justice, oh, shrieks a cry of naked terror. He's taking babies from their mamas. Thank you.
see the vulture coming, and he's flying circles in your mind. There'll be no escaping, for he will follow close behind. Only promise me a battle, yeah, battle for your soul and mine, your soul and mine. He's taking babies from their mamas.
Standing in the ruins of another black man's life, or flying through the valley, separating day and night. I am death, cried the vulture, for the people of the light, light. Charon brought his raft from the sea that sails on souls. I saw the scavenger departing, taking warm hearts to the cold. He knew the ghetto was a haven for the meanest creature ever known. In a wilderness of heartbreak and a desert of despair, evil's clarion of justice shrieks a cry of naked terror, taking babies from their mamas, leaving grief beyond compare. So if you see the vulture coming, flying circles in your mind, remember there is no escaping, for he will follow close behind. Only promise me a battle, battle for your soul and mine, and mine.
Listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM, and today's show circles like a vulture around Gil Scott-Heron with Sandra Cross, DJ Hybridist. So those were two versions of the vulture.
Yeah.
We haven't really touched on his relationship with rapping, have we? Or is that something that comes in? Because we are fast running out of time.
Yes, we're gonna have to, we are. We're gonna have to edit himself, the tracks a bit. Yeah, I do have some reference to the way that he, he'd heard, obviously, that he'd been called the godfather of rap or something like this. And he didn't subscribe to that idea at all. He says in an introduction to a collection of poems of his called Now and Then, which brings us why I'm reluctant to accept the title of godfather of rap. There seems to be a need within our community to have what the griot supplied in terms of historical chronology, a way to identify and classify events in black culture that were both historically influential and still relevant. And then he goes on to give examples of other people who he thinks are more sort of likely to have that this sort of rapping title given to them. And he talks about the last poets and their percussion-driven group deliveries who made the recordings which served to place my title, as godfather in question. And he goes on in the same sort of way. Is that really...
I mean, obviously there's a long tradition, isn't there? Of, I mean, he mentions griot or griot. I'm not quite sure how you pronounce it, which is sort of... goes way back to probably 100 years previously, where people told stories
way. Since time began, really. Mm. You know, the idea right. of oral history and oral traditions.
So it really
and so
is
on.
A question of when the word rap is first applied yes. to such a genre.
And as somebody for whom words are important, rap might not have been the word that no. he would have really taken to.
Right. So he talks about the last poets. I mean, they apparently used to perform on the street, didn't they? Without any musical accompaniment.
Right.
I think it was a cappella, just sort of standing on a street corner.
And once again, and, there's a great tradition of all of that going
yeah.
back to a barbershop.
Sort of ranters and as you say, barbershop quintets.
You know, from the 20s or probably earlier
right.
than that, the 1920s.
Yeah.
What we've got next, which is just a glorious, glorious song.
Right.
And it's called Who Pay Reparations on My Soul.
Okay.
And it's a two-part harmony.
Really? Who's the other person then?
He's a singer called David Barnes, who I know
right.
nothing about.
Okay.
But who is on this.
Yeah. No, it's all right. I've got it here. I'm stroking the microphone with my piece of paper, which
okay.
caused a slight thud.
Right.
So this is what? Who'll Pay Reparations on My Soul?
Yes, and it's from Small Talk and Lennox again.
Okay.
Pregnant and lying in bed. Stuff them all in a Harlem house, and then tell them how bad things are down south. Painted black. Who'll pay reparations on my soul? Written many directions for the aid that was given. They gave us pieces of silver and pieces of gold. Tell me who paid reparations on my soul. Many fine speeches. Summer was there and the freezing winter's cold. Now tell me who'll pay reparations on my soul. Call my brother a junkie, say he ain't got no job, no job, no job. So my old man to leave me when times got hard, so be a man. You can't depend on no one else.
Been as eccentric, as obnoxious, as arrogant, as aggressive, as introspective, as selfish. I would be who I am.
Okay, well, thank you very much for coming in with this selection from Gil Scott-Heron. What are we going to end with?
We're going to end on a rather glorious celebratory note.
Really?
And it's all about birds flying.
Oh.
And it's Gil in great voice.
No, not vultures then?
No. Just...
this is from something called Storm Music.
Just think of nice birds flying free.
Okay.
And it's setting him free.
All right, well, thanks very much for bringing them in. We might have to be a follow-up. I don't know, because there's so much stuff we haven't covered.
We've only scratched the surface.
I'm gonna take myself a piece of sunshine and paint it all over my sky, yeah. Be no rain. Be no rain. I'm gonna take the song from every bird and make them sing it just for me, yeah. Birds got something to teach us all about being free, yeah. Be no rain. Be no rain. And I think I'll call it morning from now on. Why should I survive on sadness and tell myself I've got to be alone? Why should I subscribe to this world's madness, knowing that I've got to live on? Take myself a piece of sunshine and paint it all over my sky, yeah. Be no rain. Be no rain. I'm gonna take the song from every bird and make them sing it just for me.
much for coming in and sharing it with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
This program has been brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you liked what you heard and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.